I hope you'll bear with me this evening. Fatigue hit me at midday today, and I haven't been able to bounce out of it. And I've actually found it, there hasn't been enough energy actually to organize my thoughts for this evening. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And so this may be a little bit on the disorganized side, but I'm going to really try because it feels important. So the theme of this retreat is the cure for the pain. I think we made clear at the beginning it's really about the cure for suffering rather than just pain. And if I may just sum up what we have conceived this cure to be, and I hope it has made sense to you. It's first understanding that you are responsible and only you are responsible for your happiness and your suffering. It's not your circumstances. So if you are willing to accept that premise, then your happiness and your suffering essentially depend on two things. One is understanding who you are. Know thyself. Understanding what you are. That's the most important thing. Discovering the truth about reality. And then the second thing is developing a resilient and adaptive response to your circumstances. Our suffering comes from our reactivity to what happens to us. That's the cause of our suffering. Suffering equals pain plus resistance. Suffering equals pleasure plus grasping and clinging. If you take away the resistance, there can be pain but no suffering. If you take away the grasping and clinging, there can be pleasure but no suffering. Is that clear? It's our reactivity to what happens. And so we change that reactivity into responsiveness, which actually brings us happiness rather than pain or suffering. Is that clear? I hope it is. I hope it doesn't sound too abstract. And then my suggestion has been, you know, essentially we find out who we are. We find out the truth about reality by observing reality closely, by paying close attention. It's really a scientific undertaking. You know, you're collecting data about what's going on. And if you collect enough data, what happens is that there's a moment of insight where you see. All that information eventually reaches the intuitive level and you see what is true. So, for example, we all start out with the illusion, and we often slip into the illusion of believing that there can be something we can keep in our lives, something that's permanent, something we can trust, something that's secure. And if we observe our experience closely, and if we experience the world closely, we come to discover, actually, we can't keep anything. There's nothing secure. Because it all passes away, everything, all of it. And you only really get to understand that by observing events enough times and discovering none of it lasted, did it? So, you observe reality long enough and you come to understand what reality is. Instead of our concepts, our projections, our distortions, our received beliefs from the culture, which are actually inaccurate, most of them. And the suggestion has been to pay very close attention internally, in terms of our own experience, to four things. To pay close attention to the experience of this body, to pay close attention to emotions and other states of consciousness, to pay close attention to thinking, and to pay close attention to behavior, these four things. And then really being willing to be interested enough to see how these four things interact with each other. And as you parse it out, as you come to understand it more and more precisely, you see exactly how you create your suffering through reactivity. there's an event in the body, a pain in the elbow, and then there's an emotion, oh damn, you know, this is awful, this is terrible, this is really painful. And then there's thinking, oh, it's probably never going to go away, you know, and I'm probably going to end up with an operation and they may have to amputate and, you know, and that reinforces the emotion, right? And then it leads to behavior because you're going through this process and some intimate in your life comes and says, hi, how are you? And you snap at them because you're in pain. Does that make sense? That's just one little example of how the body, the emotions, the thoughts, and the behavior can interact. And, you know, we can learn skillful response. The skillful response is same pain, exactly the same pain. You see it and you say, this is pain. It's just pain. It's not my pain. It's not me. It's just pain. So let me be with this pain. You know, it's actually not that bad. Guess I better do something about it. Do you see how clean that is? We don't have to go into reactive states because of physical pain. We can train ourselves to see that it's just what it is, and then we make some kind of practical action without reactivity. And the emotion involved might be, or the mind states involved might be, very clear attention, awareness, the quality of consciousness, and love. Oh, you poor dear body. I'm so sorry you're suffering. Let's see what we can do to help you. Do you see? Then the physical, the emotional, the thinking, and the behavior are entirely different. Can you see how one creates suffering and the other doesn't? Is that, I mean, practical enough and applied enough? So I'd like to suggest this evening to go beyond these four things, or to extend these four things. It's actually not enough just to pay attention to our own experience. We really need to be paying attention to the rest of the world. You know, so there's physical experience, and there's emotions, and there's thinking, and there's behavior here, but what about all that? And we can bring the same careful attention to the external world. I'd like to suggest, so I've used the term attunement because I like it so much, because it really combines the idea of awareness with empathy. You have to, with attunement, you have to kind of feel your way into an experience, not just observe it. And it's that combination of awareness and empathy which really cultivate the two great liberating qualities that we have. Wisdom, which comes from observation, from awareness, and love, the sense of deep connection and caring. So let's just extend it to, we don't live in isolation, we actually live in relationship. And so to extend this idea to an interaction with another person using the same four criteria. But in order to do that, we have to really get past something that is really an obstruction. And that is the fact that we believe, most of us believe, that there's a self here. And actually, if you look at it, there's a belief, there's a self here, and all the rest of it is it. You know? That person is not me. That planet is not me. And so what inevitably comes from that delusion of believing that we're really believing that we're separate is self-absorption. And I think if you're willing to actually look at the pattern of your thinking, how many thoughts are about yourself? There's a kind of narcissism that comes from the ego delusion of believing that we're a separate self. We're pretty much concerned about one thing most of the time. And don't take my word for it, just pay attention to your own experience. The great, the wonderful, funny English writer, despite the name he was English, Wei Wu Wei, said, 99% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't any. And so we actually have to get past that narcissism, that solipsism that comes from the ego delusion, and actually take an active interest in what's outside of this. I know we all do that. I know that. I know you care. You care about others. You care about the world. But I think that we can extend that quality of caring. But in order to do that, we really have to work with this self-absorption. It means actively being interested. So in an interaction with another person, it's possible to observe these four things. To observe the physical, you can't feel their physical sensations, but you can read the body language, be aware of what's happening to them physically, be aware of what's happening to them emotionally, be aware of their thinking process, which gets expressed in their speech or their communication, and be aware of their behavior. You see, we attune. We can attune to someone else if we're interested enough and if we develop the habit of doing that. That's exactly what I've been doing in the last few days with you, is that I've met with each one of you, those of you who are in this retreat and not guests who are visiting, I've met with each one of you, and it's been my total effort to attune to you in order to try to be useful to you, and we have only 15 minutes, in order to be useful to you, I'm just right there and I'm trying to figure out what's really going on here. What's happening? It's not only, you know, sort of reading the obvious signals, but actually trying to pick up the subtext. And I've been doing it for many years, and I've gotten so most of the time I can do a quick read and get some sense, okay, where is it useful for me, because I have permission to intervene, otherwise they wouldn't be in a practice conversation. Where's the best place for me to intervene here and be helpful? So it's exactly that kind of attunement. And to bring this quality of as complete presence as possible to another person, you know, and as complete attention as possible to another person, and as complete empathy as possible, to feel your way into their experience. That's transformative. So as an encouragement, can we attune to each other as individuals in our interactions? But I think we can extend that idea of attunement beyond. You know, one of the things I've been trying to do in this retreat, for example, is to attune myself to the group and to its needs. You know, to kind of feel where are we going here and what's needed and what can be helpful. And anybody who leads groups knows about that quality of attunement. That's kind of how you serve. You can't just come in with your own agenda. You have to actually feel your way into what's happening to the group so that you can respond. You know, flexible, adaptive responsiveness. And there have been any number of times when I've been leading a retreat planning to do one thing and end up doing something entirely different, because something came up in the retreat. Okay, here's what we're doing. Let's try to be adaptive. Let's try to be resilient. Do you see how that can extend beyond just our own experience of being adaptive and resilient? And I think we can extend it beyond interacting with an individual or interacting with a group, but to extend the same quality of attunement to the social and institutional aspects of our lives. You know, attune yourself to Congress. What's going on with them physically? What's going on with them emotionally? What's going on with their thinking as expressed in the words? And what's going on with their behavior? You know, we have a fully dysfunctional Congress at this point. That's really interesting. It's not what the founding mothers and fathers conceived. But something has happened, caused the whole system to jam up. And I, you know, we all know what it is. It's people who are not willing to be attuned to each other, who are not really willing to listen to each other, not willing to be really present for each other, not willing to be empathic. What if we had awakened senators and representatives? What if they were really conscious and awake? What if they had developed wisdom and love to a very deep degree? What would Congress be like? And, you know, let's throw in the Supreme Court and the President, too. And the members of the Cabinet. What kind of federal government would we have? And, you know, let's add all the bureaucrats, too. What kind of federal government would we have if people were doing the hard work that we have been doing in this retreat? Mm-hmm. The kind of purification, the kind of opening up, the kind of sensitivity, all of the qualities that we've been talking about in this retreat. It's really an interesting thing. In terms of being aware of attuning ourselves to the social, you know, I think it's really useful for us, extraordinarily useful for us to pay attention to that thinking piece, especially on the social level. You know, we have more than any generation before us, really more than any human beings before us, have access to an immense amount of communication. In the Buddha's time, there was only one way to communicate, and that was person-to-person speaking, because it was mostly an illiterate society. There's a good chance the Buddha was illiterate, and all the people around him were illiterate because writing was very, very new then. This was the very dawn of history as we know it, 2,500, 2,600 years ago. So the only way people were able to communicate then was by meeting each other and talking to each other. They couldn't read each other. They certainly didn't tweet to each other. You know? But here we have this immense amount of information and communication. Can we bring discriminating wisdom to that? You know, what is the communication that we expose ourselves to? Does that communication support our happiness and our freedom? Or does that communication support the entanglement with suffering? I think if we really bring that kind of discriminating wisdom, you know, to what we expose ourselves to, we might end up cutting out a lot of the communication, a lot of the information that's coming into our lives. It's really important for us to know what's happening, you know, to be aware of what's happening, just as we try to be aware of what's happening here, to be aware of what's happening on our planet and in our world and in our society. But a lot of that communication is toxic. You must know that. But unless we're kind of fairly alert, we allow all that toxic stuff to run through our minds and hearts. And it conditions us. And I find it also really interesting in terms of, I have this commitment to awaken, and it's a very high priority for me. And I try to pay attention, for example, to how much of my activity and how much of my exposure to the world, like to media, is about distracting myself from my pain, as opposed to looking at my pain. It's really interesting. I mean, if you really observe people and observe how they're actually living their lives, you know, the television shows and all the rest of it, the browsing, the internet, you know, the umpteenth YouTube video, you know, whatever, is it how much of that is simply to distract ourselves instead of being present, taking us out of the present? And so I've actually been working on this for years. And this is really part of attunement. Attunement to my environment is mostly, I have eliminated much of contemporary culture from my life. I rarely go to movies anymore. I've never had a television. I have a computer, but I use it in a limited way. And I don't feel like I'm isolated from the world because I make an effort to stay informed about what's happening. But I know that if I'm really suffering, that's the time to distract. You know, or if I really need to replenish myself or restore myself, that's the time for enjoyment. It's like tomorrow when I get home and I unplug the phone, you know, I'm an introvert and here I am doing this work. You know, tomorrow when I get home, I'm not going to turn on the computer. I'm going to unplug the phone and I'm going to read Calvin and Hobbes, you know, and I'm going to enjoy it, you know. Does that make sense? You know, a little bit of pleasure, a little bit of enjoyment. So that's a kind of distraction, but it really has a function. It's what I need at that time. And sometimes when I'm in terrible pain, you know, I say, okay, pain, enough already, and I turn on a Muppets television show. You know, I don't have a television, but I've got the videos of the first three seasons of the television show. And if you have any influence with Disney, get them to release seasons 4 and 5 because it's been years since. So, you know, paying attention to how much do I go into distraction and how much is the habit of distraction because I'm unwilling to be present. You know, it's very useful to have that kind of sensitivity. So attuning to another person, attuning to groups, attuning to institutions. I know that a number of people here work in institutions. It's really interesting to open up and to see, you know, what's working here and what's dysfunctional here, and why is it dysfunctional? And it's going to come right down to the Dharma. How conscious, how aware are people? How kind are they? How honest and kind are they? You know, if people can manage to get to the place of being both honest and kind, then things tend to work really well. And it's a simple thing to do. You just have to practice it. We practice it as individuals. That's what we've been trying to do here for these days. We've been trying to be honest and kind with each other. And there's been actually very beautiful communication. The question and answer periods I have found profound. So could that extend to institutions? And I just want to say that I personally, I'm only speaking from my personal opinion about it, but I'm personally feeling that it is more urgent now for us to wake up than it has ever been in the history of humanity. It's there are all kinds of signs that changes are underway and are accelerating that will bring possibly more suffering than humanity has ever experienced before. And it's so important for us collectively to get to the place where we are adaptively responsive and not reactive to our circumstance. Darwin said about species, he said, the ones that survive are not the strongest, they're the ones that are most adaptive. And I think that's kind of where we are right now. You know, in 65 million years ago, The strongest ones were the dinosaurs. And then a cataclysmic climate change happened. Big meteorite or meteor hit the Earth and caused nuclear winter. And the dinosaurs were not able to, they were cold-blooded, probably. We don't know that, actually. But they weren't able to adapt. But the mammals were. The mammals survived that cataclysmic climate change and then emerged from that period of nuclear winter to become the dominant ones on the planet. Mammals have been dominant since. So it wasn't the strong that survived. It was the adaptive that survived. And this will be true in the coming cataclysmic climate change. Those of us who are most adaptive, you know, when things get very difficult, people can become more reactive. They go into fear, and then they go into aggression. It tends to be what happens. And it's not actually necessary for us to go into fear. We will all experience fear. You may be experiencing a little bit of fear as I speak. We all have to experience the fear, but for those of us who are trained, we work our way through the fear, and then we don't have to go into the reactivity of aggression or despair, for that matter. I think it's so important. I want to recommend a book. I've only just started it, but I've read enough of it and read enough about it that I think I can recommend it with confidence. It's quite recently published. It's called A Great Aridness by William Dubuis. The subtitle is Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. William Dubuis is one of our foremost New Mexican writers. He's a wonderful writer, a very wonderful stylist. And it's been published by Oxford University Press. And with the respect that the author has and the respect that particular publishing house has means that this will probably get plenty of attention and probably deserves it. And Dubuis basically gives in considerable detail what the likely future of the Southwest is, this region. And what's happening with climate change is that some parts of the world will become wetter while other parts become drier. And we're absolutely lined up to be one of the places that becomes drier. It's not just the American Southwest. There are a number of places around the world that will become substantially drier. So that means it's going to get a lot hotter here in the Southwest, and it's going to get a lot drier. And we already, in terms of our population, as you know, we have pretty much reached the limits of water now with this. With our current population, there's going to be much, much less water. And essentially, climate scientists have seen the general arc of what's going to happen, and can explain to us why. And now they're kind of filling in the subtle details. It's not fun. You know, I keep getting these books, and I try to palm them off on my friends. They don't want to have anything to do with these books. Yeah, Eric. We know you're really concerned about that. So, I just want to, if I may, I want to end on a positive note. It's not just discriminating wisdom. It's not just our clarity that's going to get us through whatever's coming in our lives. It's love. It's really, that is the great healing power. And you may ask, you know, what is love? And it's really simple. Love is what is there when fear isn't there. You take out the fear, and what shines through is our beings are naturally radiant and loving. And so, you know, a lot of what our practice is about paying close attention to fear and reducing it. That quality of love is more and more needed in the world. And you know, actually in many ways I feel optimistic about human beings, because I find that generally speaking, we're way more conscious and way more loving than we were when I was growing up in the 40s and 50s of the last century. I remember, you know, I've always had this spiritual bent, and in working class New Hampshire in the early 1950s, there were not many spiritual choices. And if I go back to the same place in New Hampshire as I will actually next month and again in June, I just have to walk into any health food store and there in the bulletin board is full of wonderful paths. So, you know, we actually are evolving, I think, pretty rapidly. I don't know if we're evolving rapidly enough, but we are much more conscious. We are more loving. We're changing this essential tone. Just to see, you know, what has happened with racism and sexism in my lifetime has been amazing in terms of the reduction. You know, and as a gay person, I would have been killed if I came out in working class New Hampshire in the 1950s. Now I can go back and get married in New Hampshire. Is that amazing? So it's the quality of love. And I just can't emphasize it enough. It's amazing power. You know, there was a question during the question and answer period today. It was a very touching question to me. And that was, what do you do if you're in an intimate bonded relationship and loss is imminent? How do you avoid being devastated? And basically the answer is wisdom and love. The wise heart knows that all things are impermanent, and so the wise heart doesn't cling. You know, if you really come to understand impermanence, there's less and less and less clinging. So if you've gotten to a place of wisdom, you won't be devastated. It'll be hard, but not that hard. It's also possible to avoid that devastation by really loving. And it's my sense of it is, what is more devastating for us if we are in a relationship that isn't really complete between the two people? If after the separation, after the ending, there's a lot of regret, that's way more painful. And I have just found in my own life, again and again in my own life, that if I'm really whole with someone, of course it hurts if I lose them, but that sense of being whole with someone, of being complete with someone, of having really worked it through with them, is for me, it makes the loss much less painful. I've been doing for years, a person, some of you have heard me talk about this before, but it's just been wonderful. A few years ago, I just invented a personal ritual. And it has been so extraordinary for me. And what I have done, I've taken a lot of trouble to do this, a lot of travel. It's been an expensive process, and it's just been really worth it. I have gone to the places and the people who have been most important in my life, and I've done what I call ceremonies of completion with them. To go to the place or to go to the person, and say it's a person, to look that person in the eyes and say, you have been really important to me. Thank you so much. You know, to really just make that profound connection. And then, because so many of the people who are really important to me live so distant, because I've travel around all my life, then I know that when one of us dies, it's not going to be such a big deal because we're whole. Does that make sense? It's just been wonderful. I went back to Middlebury, where I went to college, and I just loved the hell out of Middlebury College in the town. And my ex-wife lives near Middlebury, and she's a recluse, and I figured she wouldn't even see me. And I went and I took her a gift, and I said, "Anne, thank you so much. You've been so important in my life." And we both felt it, you know? And I've been doing these ceremonies of completion. I did one just last month in Arizona with the person who was essentially my the first real love of my life. We lived together for years. And we spent 3 days together. And it was amazing. It was so beautiful. We hadn't seen each other for many years. It was just like, And I did a ceremony of completion with her. And both of us feel so fulfilled from that. So what I'm saying is, if you want to avoid devastation when separating, one is never sign off with anybody you love without saying "I love you." I never do. You know, when I separate from someone, or if I say goodbye on the phone, I say "I love you." That's the last thing I say. And it takes, what does it take? It takes honesty and kindness to come to completion. It takes active engagement. It takes, you know, when my friend and I were going to get together in Arizona, she said to me, "Well, I'm going to bring some of the ghosts with me." And I said, "The ghosts are welcome as long as they're willing to go on long walks." And so we dealt with the ghosts. We dealt with some of the shadow stuff between us. And it just brought us closer, do you see? We were willing to deal with the painful stuff. And if you are devastated, if you're broken, if you're shattered, you know, you can love your way through that too. I don't think we need so much to be afraid of being devastated. It happens. So I'd just like to end with a remarkable statement from Louise Erdrich, who knows from devastation. Her husband committed suicide. This is from her book, The Painted Drum. I just find such extraordinary maturity and wisdom in these words. "Life will break you. Nobody can protect you from that. And living alone won't either. For solitude will also break you with its yearning. You have to love. You have to feel it. It is the reason you are here on earth. You are here to risk your heart. You are here to be swallowed up. And when it happens that you are broken or betrayed or left or hurt or death brushes near, let yourself sit by an apple tree and listen to the apples falling all around you in heaps, wasting their sweetness. Tell yourself you tasted as many as you could." This is someone who's not afraid of being broken. We survive it, and actually, if we're on a path, we use it. So it's really having the courage to love fully. And if you love fully, you can come through devastation. I guarantee it. I've done it myself. I just want to end with a T-shirt that I have. And I only save this T-shirt for state occasions, only very special occasions, so it doesn't wear out. I found it in a gay bookstore on Capitol Hill in Seattle, Washington. And this T-shirt says, "Religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for people who have already been there." Do you see? With our spirituality, we don't have to avoid the pain. We open to the pain and we face it and we work through the pain and we come out the other side. And the two things that get us to the other side are wisdom and love, both of them. So thank you. Thanks so much.